Hello and welcome to Scriptmate, the podcast for writers who dream of seeing their words spoken by paid actors on some sort of screen. I'm your host, Tim Schulberger, writer and founder of Write LA, a script coaching and screenplay competition site. Joining me is the highly skilled and wildly opinionated writer, Tony Giambuso. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Tim.
In this episode, Tony and I are going to get stuck into a couple of writing devices that are often painfully misused. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Flashbacks and dream sequences.
Mm-hmm.
Flashbacks and dream sequences. If your script has a flashback, you need to keep listening and get the delete button ready. We're also going to tackle some questions from you, pick some movie moments that mean something, and I'll share some random Aussie trivia. But first, flashbacks.
Yeah.
If you remember last time, you will recall. Flashbacks. Flashbacks are.
I see what you did.
Pardon?
I see what you did.
Did you? Well done. At least someone did. I appreciate you just for that. I see flashbacks a lot, and I label them momentum killers.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually they are not delivering information that is essential to the progress of the story. Sometimes they are, like, I think... what's the Meryl Streep movie? Sophie's Choice.
Mm.
Didn't we finally get the flashback at the end where she has to make the choice? That's all in flashback. I think I recall that or something. So occasionally it's like the flashback reveals some horrendous trauma mm-hmm. that you've been sort of implying up until that point. So in the hands of a skilled professional, a flashback can occasionally be of use, but it's very rare and usually... it's not. Usually it's a waste of time because what I like to say is a flashback is asking the audience to pause the story. It's a bit like hitting whenever I watch – my children don't listen to this podcast, so that's okay. But often when I watch a movie with them, they will have a question and we will pause so I can answer the question,
yeah.
Right? And they're like, I don't understand what's going on. Pause. Okay, so you know, so this is what's going on. We resume. That essentially is what a flashback is yeah. doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so – why are you risking that the audience would be like, you know what, now that I've paused, I'm going to go get a sandwich?
Yeah.
You know, why would you do that? And because you're not, if you think about it, you're not advancing the story. You are revisiting something that's already happened. And I think it's far more interesting. You're also, sorry, I have too many thoughts in my head at once.
Yeah.
You're also robbing the audience of a chance to use their imagination.
Yep.
If you have a character who looks traumatized or who looks like they've damaged from something that they've experienced in the past, and that damage is in some way impacting how they are operating in the present, why do we need to see the specifics of the damage, of what happened? Why do we need the absolute literal demonstration of what caused the trauma? Couldn't it be more interesting if we just see this character that's damaged and we get ideas of what caused the damage or why they might be, and you're allowing us to start thinking about them and start to use our imagination to be like, well, I wonder what happened, or I wonder. And then even if you imply some things, our imagination will conjure something that will be really meaningful to us as individuals that may not be as impactful as whatever you show us in the flashback. So why would you rob us of that? I just find flashbacks on a story level can be really annoying because I'm going to have to read something and it's like, oh, mm-hmm. this has already happened.
Yeah.
And usually, I will say, usually the writer has implied it anyway. So yeah. it's actually not delivering information I don't already know. It's just showing me what they said.
Yeah.
And especially war movies, you know,
oh, yeah.
I read one the other day. You know, a Vietnam movie, and the guy talks about the horrors he saw in Vietnam, and then we go into a flashback where we see the horrors
yeah.
that he talked about. And so it's like,
I think so much of it comes from what writers are like, sort of one of the main rules of screenwriting, which is show, don't tell. So everyone thinks, oh, well, instead of having a character imply this or talk about, you know, the horrors of Vietnam, why don't I just show it? That's what I'm supposed to do. But in a sense, that is telling, because you are not like showing is showing the character's behavior, showing how a character who I'm interested in a character who, say, has a PTSD from Vietnam, which my father was one. And it's what's more interesting if that if he is the character of the movie, of what he doesn't say, how he doesn't say it, how he does say it, as opposed to just we, you know, track in on his eye, push in on his eyes, and we get all of the information. It's like, I want to learn through that character, as opposed to you just cutting to a moment and then you're just telling me how I'm supposed to feel. The other thing I think is that people write these intense backstories for their characters that they get really attached to. Mm-hmm. And when they're writing the script, instead of using that backstory as their tool to give the character nuance in different, you know, layers, they're like, but I need to tell you, I want to cut to like as a childhood, because this crazy thing happened to them as when they were a kid that I wrote, and it's the reason why they made this decision. And so I want to show you, right, because I came up with it. And it's like, you got to kill that. You got to just let that be the foundation for which you are building that character. And I think screenwriting is an exercise in pulling away everything that is not absolutely essential.
Yes.
And oftentimes flashbacks are just adding a thing, like you just said, that we kind of already know or could imply. And it's actually, you know, the thing they always say, or they, I don't know, me, somebody says it, give the audience 2 + 2, not 4. Yeah, Kevin said, give the audience 2 + 2, not 4. Right. Maybe Aaron Sorkin said it. And sometimes with the flashbacks, you're giving them 4. You're just saying like, here's what it is, as opposed to us having a little level of mystery. And perhaps with something like Sophie's Choice, you can build that mystery throughout the entire movie. And maybe that's why that one is more effective, yep, because we get to that point and we are just desperate. And then they're like, here you go. And we're like, oh, thank you. Catharsis. Yes. Even if it's very sad, as opposed to like right off in this, yes, first 10 pages saying, here's how we got here.
Yes. Yes. And I think in that way, it can be effective. So I'm not saying no flashbacks ever.
For sure.
But flashbacks as character development in the beginning, yep, especially bad. Mm-hmm. Because again, in our previous podcast, we talked about how important the first 5 pages are. If you've got a flashback in your first 5 pages, take it out now. Just take it out. And I promise you, your script will not suffer.
Yeah.
I read one from a client, and I have read this multiple times, where we see characters interacting in a certain way, and then we flash back to these characters interacting when they were children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, but I already know how they're interacting. I already see the closeness and the bond and all of that. I don't need to see them as children. And why are you doing that? And then there is one other aspect of flashbacks, and then we'll get on to dream sequences. Flash that is something that writers don't consider too, is that I've read scripts that take place in 2025 Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And then the flashback will be 1875 Wyoming.
Yeah.
And any producer looking at this is like, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to pay for an enormous flashback sequence, yeah, or a Vietnam War sequence, yeah, with explosions and helicopters. And, yeah. Yeah. And this is a small, you know, this is, yeah, a drama set in LA or a comedy set in LA. What are you doing to me in, yeah, terms of the budget? And for something that is largely irrelevant anyway.
Yeah.
So it's again, it's sending a message to a reader that it's like, you don't have a full grasp of the fundamentals of movie making.
Yeah.
If you are throwing in this enormously expensive flashback for really no,
well, it's going to get cut. And yeah, oftentimes I look at scripts and I say, if we were making this movie, would this scene be cut? And if it's going to be cut in the edit, then we're just going to cut it now, because, yeah, it's not useful. I think there's a couple quick on flashbacks still. There's a couple kinds that I think of, like the omniscient flashback, where the omniscient. So like the writer is saying like, I, the writer, am taking you to a place and I'm just showing you information.
Okay.
Versus like a point of view flashback, where a character is telling a story or a character is dictating to another character. And then I walked in, flashback to a week ago, and then it cuts back and the other character is like, wow, that's crazy. So like the information has been passed in the story. It's not just for us, the audience, but it's also us. And then there's little like just functional flashbacks, where I think of, and I still do this in scripts, where we get a character to a point where they need to, you know, see an object and remember something. And there's a line on page 12 where the character said, you know, the lamp is whatever. And then it's page 80. And I go, do I need to write in quick flash to the memory of the other character saying the lamp, and then they go the lamp. And sometimes for me, I think that's okay. That's a little bit of like a memory. Mm-hmm. A lot of shows do this. I think it was like Big Little Lies did it all the time. A character walks in, looks at something, and then there's a quick flash to like a feeling, a memory that they have. And it's literally 1 second. Okay. That to me obviously can get annoying on the page, but if done effective, I think is slightly different than a flashback. Like yeah. You said, character building is a good way to put it.
Yeah. And also sometimes in this, for a while there, they got into the soppy rom-coms where they had little flashback montage of the times they spent together when they're apart. And there's some nice music playing and you're like, oh, he really misses her or she really misses him. It's like, okay, sure. But because that's sort of, you're reminding us of stuff we've already seen, I suppose. Yeah. But so I suppose flashbacks really as a way of building a character or something are really there. That's when they're least necessary.
Yeah.
They're also expensive. And so really think about it when you're like, oh, I'm going to throw in a flashback. It's like, well, do we need it? Or can you use the audience's imagination to have them conjure up something? I would argue probably 9.5 times out of 10, you'll find a path without having to invest in a flashback and pause the story and ask your audience to wait around while you fill it in. Oh, which, but by the way, is another aspect of this where you have characters explaining to other characters something that we've already seen as an audience member, which is, please don't do
that.
Get rid of that. I don't even know what that's called. We have to come up with a name for that. But it's like, that wastes so much time in a script. So yeah, so flashbacks. Speaking of wasting time, dream sequences.
Yeah. Off the top of my head, I thought of a couple of dream sequences that I really liked. And they worked because they didn't tell us that they were dream sequences and they weren't, I mean, which generally they don't, but it's aliens. She is just in the hospital bed, Ripley, and then the alien pops out of her chest and then she wakes up. And it is representing some sort of trauma. We think we're in the present. And it also makes sense. She just came from a ship where the aliens were bursting out of the chest. She would have that fear. And also it gives the audience their first chest, I forget what it's called, the chest ripper or whatever it's called, and they chest burster or whatever. And they we get that early in the movie, even if it hasn't actually happened yet to a character. And I think that one worked really well versus just we see something and then a character wakes up and we're meeting them for the first time. Another one that worked really well was in High Fidelity. There's a scene when John Cusack to Tim Robbins, he talks shit and then I think he punches him in the face and then it just cuts and he hasn't said or done any of those things. And it's sort of, oh, that was something he wanted to do, but he didn't. But it didn't again, push in on him and then cut to his dream. The movie just did it. And I thought that was a useful device. But in general, go on. You have some things.
No. Is that a dream sequence or a fantasy?
So actually, I wrote dream sequence /fantasy. So, okay. I mean, I guess.
I would argue that I'm thinking about this. I would argue that a fantasy is different from a dream sequence.
Okay, yeah.
Because a fantasy is a waking desire from the character that we're seeing and they're imagining an alternate reality which has been used a lot and can sometimes be very effective.
Yeah.
A dream sequence is not in the control of the character. It's a dream because we don't control our own dreams unless you do and please tell me how. So throwing in a dream sequence of a character is sort of, I guess, trying to let the audience know of what the subconscious of this character is thinking about and what they would like to have happen. I, again, would argue, much like flashbacks, it's a waste of time because if you're doing a good enough job with this character, we know what they want. Mm-hmm. Now, whether they're getting it or whether they're asking, going for it or whether they're being as effective as they could be, that's, the movie probably. Where they have a dream and they're not fulfilling it, and then over the course of the film they fulfill it. But so what's the point of the dream sequence? Mm-hmm. Is it just to show the sort of the psyche of the character, which is oftentimes in the scripts that I read, it is. It's like I'm gonna do this weird dream sequence where none of it is real. Especially opening with it and then cutting to them waking up in bed in a cold sweat. I'm like, oh, I just wasted. You just wasted two or three of your crucial first 5 pages on something that isn't real, and I don't have to really factor into the rest of the story because it's not real. So why are you doing this to me?
I think you said it well with flashbacks as well. If you're using it to develop the character as opposed to the actual character in real time in the script, then that's probably a place you want to circle your dream sequence or your flashback and say, is this the right time to use it? Because like anything else, we could name a million flashbacks and dream sequences and fantasies that do work, but in general, it's one of those things that are used as a crutch or used as a band-aid or as a cheat to say, like, I just want to tell you everything you need to know about this character in three pages, which also we don't want. That's the 2+2 thing. It's right. Like, don't tell me everything about the character. And I get it. Sometimes people will read a script and say, I want to know more. I want to know more. And like, that's kind of, you want the balance of not I'm confused, but I'm interested. I want to know more. I have to keep reading to figure out what is happening and why this character is the way they are, as opposed to you just dumping it all on me in the first five pages.
Right. And I do see, and I also, I would argue the dream sequence as well as a flashback is sort of a bit of a high wire act. You know, it's to be used cautiously. It's to be used really thoughtfully. It's to be used concisely. And it's sort of, it's one of those, what do they say? It's like when you watch these commercials and they say, this was performed by stunts people, please do not do this at home or a TV show. It's a bit like that. Mm. It's like get the fundamentals of the craft right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really get your command of craft going up and running before you start dabbling in stuff like dream sequences and flashbacks, because they're really the stuff. I'm not saying only to be used by professionals, because the professionals get it wrong all the time, but they're sort of then the next level. They're the nuanced stuff. They're the little bits and pieces where you really have to know what you're doing with them. And I just don't think you need to worry about it, because the risk, again, high wire act, the risk of getting it wrong is so much greater. And you end up giving the totally wrong message to anybody reading your script who doesn't know you from a bar of soap, and they're reading what they're reading on the page is defining what they think of you as a writer. And if you're launching into a dream sequence to introduce a character, you're instantly communicating a message to them that you are playing with highly volatile explosives, and you don't have your explosives license yet. It might work. You know, you might not blow
anything
yourself up.
Can work. That's the thing. Yeah. There's no like rules, but there are. I agree with this fully. There's nothing. It's never to say you can't do this, can't do that. It's just these are the things that generally are associated with things that are not working, and these are generally crutches. And consider that when you're working on your craft and building your craft and growing as a writer. Because I think about it with improv as well. When I would take improv, they'd say, you know, never say no. They used to call it pimping someone out. They probably don't call it that anymore. But where I'd say, oh, Tim, what was that poem you wrote about me? And then you're on stage having to read a whole poem, things like that. Never do that. But then when you go to the best shows, the best improv shows, a Herald or whatever, you realize that they do those things all the time. But these are the best of the best of the best. And they know that they can pull that off, or that you'll have a poem at the ready, or that I can go against yes and it'll still be effective because we've worked together. But in 101, you know, maybe avoid all of those things.
Yeah.
And I think that's...
Yeah. And I think sometimes people go and see, what is it, Inception? Is that the dream one from Christopher Nolan?
Yeah.
Go and see Inception and be like, I can do that. And it's like, I'm sorry, Christopher Nolan can't do that. I mean, it makes no sense. So to sort of go, but that got made. And to use that as an example, like, well, I can delve as much as I can take all of these risks. It's like, sure you can, but just understand that there's an excellent chance that the thing's going to explode in your face rather than you getting it right. And that applies to the people who get all the money and all of the opportunities. And when you're learning the craft, it's really important to get the basics right, because you can do a really entertaining, compelling, powerful, attractive script without a dream sequence or without a flashback. I promise you. And it doesn't have to have all the bells and whistles. It doesn't have to show your spectacular command of stunts. It can be small, and it attracts just as much attention because it demonstrates your command of craft and your ability to connect an audience with characters and to make people feel. And if you don't think that that's important, listen to the podcast that we did with Sean, the literary manager, where he said, feelings matter.
Mm-hmm.
How I feel about things is really, if I don't feel something, I'm not going to want to work with that writer. So I know that you think a dream sequence will show the longing of a character or show what they're really thinking about. Just use it very wisely and very cautiously,
I would say,
because it can all go spectacularly wrong, and I've seen it.
Do you want to tell me a movie moment that stuck out to you?
Well, speaking of stunts, Fall Guy. I watched Fall Guy.
Oh, wow.
Again. I saw it in the cinema. It's funny. I've been watching a lot of films that I've seen already over the holiday break. And a lot of rom-com type things because I'm dabbling in a rom-com at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how films evolve when you haven't seen them for a while. And you walk away from it with one feeling and then you watch it a few years later or a little while later. And I walked away from Fall Guy when I saw it in the theater being like, well, that's a missed opportunity. You know, it's like it got too obsessed with stunts mm-hmm. and Emily Blunt's character disappears. She's just does so much like glassy eyed, which is almost crying, thinking that Ryan Gosling's dead or leaving her so many times in the second half of that movie that it was sort of I just kept thinking missed opportunity. And then I watched it again and you know what? It's fun on the couch. It's fine. You know, all those problems are still there, yep. but Ryan Gosling is a peak charismatic Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
And he does a very nice emotional scene when he's on the boat outside the Sydney Opera House and where he really does, and when he thinks he's going to die. I mean, Ryan Gosling really brings it in this movie. Mm. I feel sorry for Emily Blunt. I don't know why she seems to pick a lot of movies where she doesn't do anything. Oppenheimer is the perfect example of that. I mean, her container of whiskey had more scenes than she did. Anyway, I'm off track. So Fall Guy is a great example of all the pieces were there, but the script got too focused on action. I know it was made by stunt people for stunt people, and it was coming from a TV show, but it lost its way in somehow along the way when they were putting it together, they got more obsessed with the stunts than they did with the characters. And so that's a challenge when you're writing a script, especially an action script. Scripts are a constant, and I say this a lot, scripts are a constant balancing act. You're constantly, and that's again where we talked about feedback in a previous podcast. Feedback's important because you need other people to be like, have I got the balance right? You know, is it too much of this and not enough of that? I'm constantly tweaking how I can give you an entertaining experience that has all the elements and not one of them dominating at the expense of the other ones. And when something other than characters is dominating, your script moves into dangerous territory in terms of it might fail. And I think Fall Guy ultimately did not earn the sort of money they were hoping, because even though they had great chemistry between Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, because it got too focused on the wrong things that the audience ultimately didn't care as much about.
Yeah, I really liked Fall Guy. And I feel like if it had decided if it was an action movie with some romance or a romance movie with some action, it would have connected maybe more to audiences. It was a very, very entertaining movie. I agree with everything you said. But yeah, I don't think people really knew what it was. And I don't think it really knew what it was.
No, I don't think it did.
While also being interesting.
I will say Hannah Waddingham, I think, was miscast.
Oh, yeah.
No offense to
Hannah.
I mean,
she's great. But
she's great.
Yeah.
But that wasn't. That wasn't good.
So my moment is from a movie. I didn't have a chance to rewatch the scene, but it's from a movie called Mississippi Grind.
Ooh.
So Ryan Reynolds is in it, but it's very different than what you would think. It's a sort of like a gambling movie, a gambling drama. Alfre Woodard and Ben Mendelsohn are in this scene.
He's Australia's own.
Yep. He's the essentially the main character of the movie as a, you know, a gambling problem. And there's just a scene in the movie where he's at a diner and we don't know.
Ben Mendelsohn or Ryan Reynolds?
Ben Mendelsohn is at a diner with Alfre Woodard. And it's the first time I believe that she comes into the movie and she's sitting there having their coffee. And for the first minute or so of the scene, they're just talking. They're talking about life. They're talking about, and then she brings, and it's very friendly. She brings up his daughter and he's like, oh yeah. And he's talking to his daughter. And then she kind of brings up where the daughter goes to school. And then it's revealed halfway through the scene that she is the bookie that he, or the person that he essentially owes money to. And if he doesn't pay them, she's going to. So they've both, there's this weird relationship where they're friends. They know each other. They have a history together, but also he's in a very vulnerable situation where she's also now transitioned into threatening him and his family. And I always think of that scene when I'm writing where I love that we didn't have to start the scene by saying, hi, bookie, you know, hi, whatever.
Right.
We just go, oh, this is like a lived-in relationship. And then halfway through, I'm like, oh. Because in real life, you sit down with two people having a conversation. You have no idea. You could think someone's on a first date, but they've been together for 10 years. You have no idea what the backstory is. And I love that. And it didn't feel kitschy. Like it felt like natural. And that's how that scene would go, where he's sort of trying to just be cool and be chill. And then all of a sudden she's like, all right, now we got to talk about the lots of money that you owe me.
Right.
So I just found that to be really effective. And just as a good model of screenwriting, that scene to sort of that 2+2 thing where it's like we're sort of slowly leading the audience into what the real relationship is
between these people. How you use language and how you deliver information is so important.
Yeah.
And yeah, I read scripts all the time where there are characters who spent years and years together, but they're giving really horribly awkward exposition because the audience needs to know. The writer's like, oh, I need to bring you up to speed. So it's like, hey, Jeremy, how are you doing with your job running the deli that you've been doing for 5 years and your children, Melissa and Barbara and your dog, Kenny? And it's like, but don't you work together every day? I mean, aren't you, why are you doing this?
Hey, bro-in-law.
yeah.
It's like,
why are you doing this? You're doing this for our benefit and we know it. And that's awkward. So that's nice. Okay.
Questions. Some questions. Yeah. So we had a couple of questions. So I'll just paraphrase, but it's about writing choreography. If the fight is taking,
So like stunt choreography, not
dancing. So if you're writing a movie that is, I'm writing an action movie and there's a fight scene, how much of that am I writing? Am I writing everything that you see? Am I writing the vibe? How do I, a person who isn't necessarily interested in, the choreographer, I'm not a choreographer, how do I write that in my script? How do I get that across in my script?
By the way, the only time I ever worked with a stunt coordinator was I was in the room in Borat when they did the naked fight.
Oh. I love that there's a choreographer for that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A stunt. Oh, yeah. They had to, because they broke the lamp and the window. Mm. Well,
intimacy coordinator, though, right?
No. Should have been. And that, by the way, just a small fact, that room was booked under my name. So if they got kicked out, it was my, I can't go to the airport Hilton in LA. It's funny. There are different schools of thought on this. I know that a lot of writers feel that they will impress. This is a whole part of the voice conversation, which we will get into later on in another episode. You know, if I come up with a really kick-ass stunt scene, you're going to see that I'm really kick-ass at writing action. Mm-hmm. And therefore I will be, working on Hollywood movies in a moment, in a studio, big studio films, because I'm really good at this action stuff. I'm really inventive. And then there's another school of thought from pretty much everybody I've ever talked to actually in the industry who's reading a lot of scripts, where they say, as soon as I see an action sequence, I kind of scroll down to see if any major character dies. I skim through it just to see if anybody dies, if there's anything that comes from it that I need to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Because whatever you invent, it's going to change when we go onto the set. It's going to change when a stunt coordinator comes on board, when a director comes on board, all that kind of stuff. It's like, okay, fine, car chase, blah, blah, blah. Does my main character, what's the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue, as an answer to that question, less is more. Reading scripts at this level is as much a game of visual as well as written. Mm-hmm. So when you as a reader see an entire page, a block of words, all scene description, so it looks like an actual novel describing some action sequence, it might be the greatest, most inventive action sequence that's ever been written. And I will still groan, and so will everybody who is reading it.
Yeah, I think that what you're doing when you're writing an action scene is you're doing the same thing that you do in every other scene, which is, if it's two guys sitting in a podcast room with laptops, we're not saying, we're saying only what the audience needs to know. They're not saying, Tim touches his chin and then lifts his right leg and then his left leg and then his right legs and he walks forward. And so in a fight scene, it's like you're telling us what is important, who has the upper hand, who, how the story and the characters are shifting and how the fight is doing that. And maybe the style and vibe. There's two scripts I would just recommend. One is the any Bourne script, where it's, or any script written by Tony Gilroy, but the Bourne script specifically, they write the action. It's beautiful because it's fun, it's exciting, it's propulsive, but they're not literally saying, Bourne gives three left, hooks and then one knee to the stomach. They don't do that. Also, slightly different than fight choreography, but the movie La La Land, I think the script for that is great, from Damien Chazelle, where there's no lyrics. Also, lyrics but there's no lyrics in the script. I would avoid lyrics.
Tony made a face, by the way. When he said lyrics, he made a face.
I gloss over that as well.
Oh my God, I hate lyrics in
but
scripts.
But he just wrote the, he didn't have any songs, so he just wrote or was working on them at the time. He just wrote sort of the set pieces of the songs, but it was the feelings, how the characters are changing, the vibe of the song, the feel of the song, and the energy without saying, you know, these are the words they say. He jumps on the car and does a little twirl and all that stuff. And so it's just a really, it was really instructive for me when I wrote some things that had music and or fight scenes for the, both of those scripts were really helpful.
All right, great.
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, so choreography, less is more. Aussie trivia, quick one, another involving me. It's a Steven Seagal story. It's very quick because I know we're running out of time. You know Steven Seagal, one-time action hero.
Mm-hmm.
He had this movie Under Siege, which was really his biggest one, where he's on a boat and he as a cook and he murders everybody basically with a spoon.
Mm.
It's a fantastic. Gary Busey's in it before his accident. It's just this. Just this gloriously stupid movie. So Under Siege. I was working at Village Roadshow as a film publicist. I worked there for 6 months and it was during Under Siege and that was one of the movies. Come to work one day and they say, Steven Seagal is coming to Australia. Get him booked on whatever you can. He's coming like in a week. It's all of a sudden. Move quickly. Any talk show, radio, whatever. Get on it as soon as I walked in. So I'm on the phone. Half an hour later, scratch that, he's not coming. So cancel everything. It's like, okay, well, I hadn't made that many, so it's okay. I said, why? Oh, the official story is scheduling conflicts. Okay, fine. Why? What's the real story? Real story, Steven Seagal would not come to Australia if he could not bring his guns. And the Australian government said, you cannot bring your guns.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I'm not coming.
And you don't just mean like his biceps, right?
No, his weapons. And not a spoon. He could have brought a spoon.
He could have just brought a spoon.
That would have been fine. But no, he wanted to bring his guns.
Yeah.
And apparently as soon as they said, Steven, no, you can't. He's like, well, I'm not coming. Screw you.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And who you think is the good guy in that story is just that's...
Well, I think it was a missed opportunity because I think Steven Seagal on Australian talk shows would have been its own, you know, joy.
Holding guns.
One can only hope. So maybe Australia is just, you know, the nanny state where it's like, boo, not let him in with his guns. What's the worst that could happen?
So see what he does.
Yeah. But yeah, so apparently that was it. That's the inside story.
Amazing.
So there you go. And that's it for this episode. Scriptmate is brought to you by Write LA, a website where you can get all sorts of information about writing, learn about my script feedback services, and get the details of our annual screenplay competition, Write LA, which is currently open for entries and stays open until March 4th, 2025. Go to write-la.com for all the details. There is a special discount exclusively for you who is listening to this podcast. The code word for a 10% discount is, Tony?
Pod, P-O-D.
Pod. It works on the entry portals Coverfly, Film Freeway, and our own website, write-la.com. Again, the code word is pod. Our theme music was written and performed by the Australian band The Swarm. Big thanks to them. And our beautiful graphic was designed by my talented daughter, Claire Schilberger. Thank you for listening. We are grateful. If you have a question you want answered, email me at tim@write-la.com. We'll be back soon. But for now, say goodbye, Tony.
Goodbye.